All right. Now we then have to get to the point of looking at the different neurotransmitters in terms of their characteristics. And what we're going to do is first concentrate on cholinergic transmission. And this means then transmission that involves acetylcholine. Now, it doesn't matter whether you're talking about an autonomic ganglion, either sympathetic or parasympathetic, or the postganglionic parasympathetic neuroeffector junction, or the skeletal muscle junction, or really, actually, cholinergic systems in the brain. They've all got these same components to them that you see in the diagram. So learn this, and you've got it made for an awful lot of pharmacology if you know what the system components are. You make acetylcholine in nerve endings by taking choline in by an uptake mechanism and combining it with acetyl-CoA via the enzyme choline acetyl transferase. That's not particularly of interest to pharmacology because we don't have drugs that affect that enzyme system, but you need to know it for physiology anyway. And you make acetylcholine from that enzyme, and acetylcholine gets stored in these little vesicles or granules that are near the nerve ending. So you see these little circles where we're showing acetylcholine getting incorporated into these vesicles and actually staying there until something happens. What's going to happen? Well, you see, the nerve for which this is a nerve ending actually is going to get activated by something, and you're going to have an impulse come down to this part of the nerve ending at the level of the membrane. And you're going to change membrane voltage down at this end, opening a calcium ion channel. So calcium is going to run down its concentration gradient. It's going to flow into the nerve ending and cause fusion of the vesicles of acetylcholine with the presynaptic membrane. And that's going to allow for acetylcholine to be released into the junction between this nerve ending and whatever the effector cell is that this nerve ending is feeding. It could be another nerve, as it would be in autonomic ganglia. But it also could be a cell, like a gland cell or a smooth muscle cell or what have you. So I'm not specifying that this is another neuron, although it could be, but it could be any cell that has receptors on it that will respond to acetylcholine. So what receptors are we going to need? We're either going to need a nicotinic receptor or a muscarinic receptor. So acetylcholine goes across the junction, and I've widened it so as I can get a few more things in there, but you know, in terms of the actual dimensions, the nerve ending is very close to the target effector cell. And on the effector cell, we've got the receptors there, which can be activated by acetylcholine. So for example, if the effector cell was the heart, we're expecting muscarinic receptors there to be activated and a slowing of heart rate to take place. If the receptor happened to be on the skeletal muscle junction, you might expect a depolarization event to occur, leading to a twitch. So, you know, a muscle twitch. So, you know, in essence, it depends on the target, you know, organ or cell, what the response is going to be. But in all cases, acetylcholine is going to activate a receptor. Now, this type of action can occur quite quickly. Acetylcholine can have an effect within, you know, much less than a second on a target tissue. If it took more than a second for me to tell my hand to be waving around like this, you know, that would be ridiculous. It takes just, you know, some very small amount of time for acetylcholine to be released, in this case, from somatic nerves. Now, how do you stop the effect? Well, the primary way you stop the effect of acetylcholine is to metabolize it. Because on the effector cells, there is the enzyme acetylcholinesterase. And if you were to then say, well, what does this do? It breaks down acetylcholine. To what? Well, to acetate and choline. And the choline is taken back up into the nerve ending and used again by combining it with acetyl-CoA. So you see, this goes right through a cycle of events in terms of cholinergic function. You get your choline back, and you make new acetylcholine, and you do the same thing over and over and over. Now, just looking at this system, I've told you already that really there is no drug that works on acetyl-CoA that has clinical significance. There really isn't any drug that works on choline that has clinical significance, to be honest with you. There are some tools that they've used to study cholinergic function, but we don't have any drugs, really, in the strict sense of the word. What about a drug that might affect the release of acetylcholine? Well, you know, botulinus toxin is a drug. It is approved as a drug for very selective purposes, not to be running around in our body, but we might be able to use it, for example, to get rid of wrinkles under our eyes by injecting Botox, it's called, botulinus toxin. How does it work? It inhibits the release of acetylcholine. Now, it's of most interest, of course, in botulinism. Botulinism is food poisoning, a type of food poisoning, isn't it? It's produced by a Clostridium organism to produce this toxin. How does botulinus work? It prevents the release of acetylcholine from these nerve endings by interacting with various proteins, including one called synaptobrevin, that is involved in the release of acetylcholine. So at least we do have a drug there that can prevent release, but obviously not of right primary clinical significance, but it is at least a drug, but it's more interest really in the context of poisoning, food poisoning, and botulinism. So when it comes to drugs, what have we got? Well, really, we've got drugs that can either activate a muscarinic or nicotinic receptor. You know one of them already, don't you? You know nicotine. Nicotine will activate a nicotinic receptor, and we've got drugs that will also activate muscarinic receptors. You don't really have acetylcholine as a drug, and you know why? Because within just a second or so, it's metabolized by acetylcholine esterase. So you can't use it pharmacologically, all right? And it does remind you then of how rapid this inactivation event takes place. And it's a very important type of property to know. Why? Well, because we're going to use drugs to inhibit that enzyme. And they're going to be called, obviously, acetylcholine esterase inhibitors. And this is a very prominent target for influencing cholinergic function. Anywhere that acetylcholine is a transmitter, a drug that inhibits its metabolism will potentiate its effect. Right? It doesn't matter whether it's in the ganglia, whether it's at the skeletal muscle, whether it's at the parasympathetic neuroeffector junction. Wherever acetylcholine is released from a nerve to activate a receptor, it's inactivated by this enzyme. And if you inhibit this enzyme with drugs, then you will enhance the activity of acetylcholine at all those sites. Do you understand? That's the important feature. It has to be an innervated site. It will not happen if you don't have nerves. You see, because this is enhancing an endogenous neurotransmitter. You need the endogenous transmitter to get anywhere with a cholinesterase inhibitor. So really, pharmacologically speaking, when we look at this diagram here, we can say the most interest is in two arenas. We can either activate or block receptors, or we can inhibit acetylcholinesterase. That's a simplification of it, but I think it's good enough for us, and it certainly is very good in comparing with the complexities of adrenergic transmission, which we will get to later. So here we go, the summary. Acetylcholine synthesized via choline acetyl transferase accumulated. Calcium runs in when we have a voltage-dependent opening of the channels. Fusion of the vesicle allows acetylcholine to be released, and you can block that with botulinum toxin. Inactivation by acetylcholine esterase, ACHE, and this is the major mechanism of termination, and it's a target for inhibitors, indirect-acting cholinomimetics. All right, why do we call them cholinomimetic? Because they mimic the action of acetylcholine. So that terminology is very commonly used. You should know what it means. Why do we say indirect acting? Because cholinesterase inhibitors do not work on receptors directly. They merely allow acetylcholine to have a greater action by virtue of inhibiting metabolism of acetylcholine. That's the important thing, and you need innovation for those drugs to work. Postjunctional cholinergic receptors are targets for both activating drugs and for blockers. Now, Depending on the receptor subtype, different drugs can be activators. We already have discussed now, or mentioned now, nicotine as an activator of nicotinic receptors. Well, the other type of receptor that is of interest to us is a muscarinic receptor, which are those that are present at the parasympathetic postganglionic neuroeffector junction and also present at the thermoregulatory sweat glands. Now, muscarinic receptors are activated by different drugs. One of the drugs that we use quite a lot clinically is an analog of acetylcholine called bethanacol. And bethanacol activates muscarinic receptors without doing anything to nicotinic receptors. Methacholine actually will work on both types of receptor, both nicotinic and muscarinic. Pilocarpine is a plant product that happens to work only on muscarinic receptors. So really, you've got two plant products here. You've got nicotine working on nicotinic receptors, which comes from the nicotine plant, you know, the tobacco plant, and you've got pilocarpine, which works, a plant product, only on muscarinic receptors. Now, what about the antagonist drugs? Well, the antagonist drugs, again, are selective in terms of the receptors. They, again, are going to be active depending on which receptor that you look at. Nicotinic receptors, as I said before, fit into two categories, nicotinic NN, which is in all ganglia of the autonomic nervous system, and we have drugs that block those receptors, which have very little clinical use, if any. Hexamethonium is one of them, mecamylamine is another one of them, and you need to know these names. Hexamethonium is a very good example of a drug that has been mentioned on examinations, although it has never been used clinically in the United States. Why has it been mentioned? Because they want you to know it's a ganglionic blocking drug, and you'll see a little later why that becomes very important. Nicotinic receptors at the skeletal muscle are called NM, and we've got drugs that block that receptor without necessarily affecting the other nicotinic receptor. Tubulcurarine, that comes from the curare, the arrow poison, is a skeletal muscle relaxant. Atracurium is a synthetic version of that. Succinylcholine is also a skeletal muscle relaxant. So these are antagonists of acetylcholine at the nicotinic NM receptor. And then you have antagonists at muscarinic receptors. Muscarine, by the way, is a plant product. It gave its name to this receptor subtype, but the only time you're going to see muscarine is in toxicology, if you happen to eat the wrong type of mushrooms, and you'll see muscarine poisoning. We don't use it as a drug, but we use the name muscarinic to denote distinction from nicotinic, and we have different drugs that act as antagonists as muscarinic receptors. Atropine is the prototype, a plant product coming from the belladonna plant, but we've got plenty of others that are made synthetically or that are derived from other products. Scopolamine is a naturally occurring compound, but benztropine and glycopyrrolate, which will be mentioned later to you in terms of their clinical uses and pharmacological properties, are example of muscarinic blocking agents. Very common clinical applications.